So if I can have everybody sit down, please. We can get the stragglers from outside. So on our second day, we usually start a little bit later, as you can see. Those of you who are just waking up on a snowy Tuesday in New York, good morning. I put on our on the screen our website. For those of you who don't know it, the Crime Report, you should all know it and should be subscribing. We are streaming the conference. We streamed yesterday's events. It's a very good summary of what went on, for those of you who need the extra sort of backup for notes. And Graham Cates, our deputy editor, who's in the back, Graham, raise your hand, is doing the streaming. We're going to be live blogging today as well, and connecting to videos, tweeting and retweeting and the whole work. So you'll be kept informed, and it'll be a record for you when you get back home. So the second day, we're really continuing our theme of smart justice. And I don't know about you, but I was really struck by some of the really interesting comments that we had from our panelists yesterday. When we thought about smart justice, we didn't think about the obvious counter, which is that we do too much of dumb justice. And I kept hearing that throughout the first couple of panels, and that's sort of a refrain in my mind. And I'm thinking of Jerry Madden yesterday, who talked about the two types of criminals or offenders, the ones that we're mad at and the ones that we're afraid of. And they're kind of simplistic notions, but they're kind of interesting to carry through in our discussions today. We're really trying to get a little bit further into the into some specific issues that relate to crime, to smart justice. Usually at the Guggenheim Symposium, we sort of wander off into a lot of different themes because we try to cover a lot of what we think are the thematic keys over the past year in criminal justice issues and criminal justice coverage. But it's kind of hard to avoid, especially in a year or in a 12-month period like what we've just been through, an election, horrible tragedies, that we don't think about different ways of addressing a wide range of criminal justice issues. So today we've got another full program. The public program will end about 3:15. I should have known this because we did the agenda. But we have a lunch, and then we end with our last public panel at. And at 12:30, that's right. Well, we do have a public panel, panel 7, just after lunch, which is on pretrial conviction in the year of the 50th anniversary of Guillen versus Wainwright. So that everybody's invited to. And then we break up into special workshops for our fellows and invited guests. And if any of you would like to attend some of those workshops, we're able to get some of you in. And these workshops are basically for our journalist fellows, reporting fellows, to talk about specific issues, skills assistance, no secrets, no special journalistic secrets that we keep to ourselves and nobody else can know. But I mean, it's we try to keep it close and intimate so we can talk frankly and candidly among each other. But they're not that close. So if you have a reason, if you want to jump in, please let me know or let Kara know or one of us. And if there's space, we'll be sure to be delighted to have you. So we've got two really great panels this morning. But before we get into them, I have a particular honor in welcoming our second keynote speaker, our first keynote speaker of today, who is Mary Lou Larry. She's the Acting Assistant Attorney General, as you all know. It's really a real honor to have her here with us, particularly in very busy time in Washington right now. Mary Lou was appointed Acting Assistant Attorney General in March of 2012. As head of the Office of Justice Programs, she oversees an annual budget of more than $2 billion, at least last count. We don't know what the inflation rate is or what's going to happen after the fiscal cliff, which we don't know if we're ever going to hit, which is basically dedicated to supporting state, local, and tribal criminal justice agencies, an array of juvenile justice programs, a wide range of research, evaluation, and statistical efforts, and comprehensive services for crime victims. So there's a lot on her plate, in her portfolio, a lot to talk about, and as it happens, a lot of stuff that we are looking at this conference. So I'm very, very, our full bio, of course, is in your program, but I'm really honored to welcome Mary Lou Leary to our podium today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Steve. I'm delighted to be here, and I feel very honored to have been asked to speak to you. And I love this theme, smart justice. If you look at my bio, you'll see that for many years I was a prosecutor, an assistant DA in Massachusetts, and assistant US attorney in Washington, DC. So I don't mean to cast aspersions on the entire profession, but I do know what dumb justice is about when you get into the, especially, you know, as an assistant DA, there's a certain rhythm of processing cases, and that after a while you begin to think, am I making a difference when you see the same defendant for the fourth time in 2 years? Fortunately, we've come a long, long way in the last, must have been 25 years ago when I started as a prosecutor, and I'm very pleased that prosecutors, too, as you can see from the website with U.S. Attorney Loretta Lynch's quote about building more prisons is not smart justice. So prosecutors even have come a long, long way. So it's a privilege to join all of you, practitioners and journalists and researchers who are working in this field of criminal justice today, which is so vibrant and so exciting. And I want to commend you on your theme of smart justice, because I think it's a suitable way to honor Harry Guggenheim's principles and his spirit of scientific pursuit and his determination to solve some of the most vexing problems that we face in society. And I feel like his spirit is alive and well here among the people in this room. And I'm very pleased to see this collaboration among researchers and practitioners and journalists. We so need each other. I commend Steve and the Center on Media, Crime, and Justice for their pioneering work, really, to advance that kind of collaboration. I think that the center has been such a catalyst for informing our practice, informing our research, and informing the reporting of crime and criminal justice, and that is such an impact on not just on public perception, but on the public understanding. What do they really understand about what's going on in their own communities, and what do they understand about the causes of crime, and what makes up the criminal justice system, what works and what doesn't work? You play such a critical role in that, and in, frankly, I think, shaping people's willingness and readiness to be open-minded about criminal justice issues. You all have really played a very strong role in moving the discussion forward, and we see researchers breaking new ground and practitioners paying attention to that, learning from the research, implementing that in their practice, which is really what we're all about at the Office of Justice Programs. And then you see journalists kind of leaning into the social science research to inform their reporting about crime. I think that it's not too far a stretch to say that we're in a new era of intellectual curiosity about the causes and the consequences of crime. And that goes for us in the federal government as well. Yes, we do have a sense of intellectual curiosity. I am announcing that here in this room today. If you think back, you know, it was President Johnson's Crime Commission report. The final emphasis of that report was the greatest need in criminal justice is the need to know. And that need has always, always been great. But I think that it's only been very recently that we have fully embraced that as a practical goal to be met. And I have some hope that in an era of striking partisanship, there is actually some agreement on various issues in the criminal justice arena. And that's wonderful progress. So my agency, the Office of Justice Programs, is charged with helping state, local, tribal entities and nonprofits and researchers and so on improve public safety and, you know, advance criminal justice, the criminal justice system. So I am really proud, actually, of what the Office of Justice Programs has done in the last few years to improve knowledge in the field about what works in criminal justice and in juvenile justice. Many of you know our National Institute of Justice, the research arm, and the Bureau of Justice Statistics, our statisticians, our number crunchers, our analysts, and they've always had a mandate to build on the base of knowledge in the criminal justice arena. But in recent years, we have really expanded the scope of our research and data gathering activities, and we've made a concerted effort to inform all of the work we do across the Office of Justice Programs with research and data. Beginning in 2009, we launched what we call our Evidence Integration Initiative, and it has a nickname, E2I. And this is really an ambitious effort to make scientific evidence the foundation of all of our work, our grant-making work, our victim services work, and then, of course, our research and data. And it's become the touchstone of everything that we do programmatically, whether it's supporting law enforcement agencies, working on juvenile justice reform, managing sex offenders, and so on. And we hope, through this effort, not only to improve the quantity and the quality of the data that we generate, but we want to use it to inform our own policies and our own program development, and perhaps most importantly, to disseminate that to the public and to the field. I think that there's no greater responsibility for the Office of Justice Programs than to build this base of knowledge and then disseminate it to the field. We have all kinds of practitioners out there who need practical information that's informed by research, and they need it in accessible, digestible forms. A police chief, a mayor, a victim service provider, they can't go delve into the research and read the methodology and so on and so forth. It's up to us to find out what's out there and to generate new knowledge about the issues, and then provide it in a way that's actually useful on the ground. That work under the E2I is also reflected in a new database that we launched a couple years ago called crimesolutions.gov. And has anybody here used that website? Oh, good. I'm glad to see that. This website, crimesolutions.gov, was actually the brainchild of my predecessor, Lori Robinson, whom many of you know. And Lori said, look, if I'm the mayor in Dubuque and I have a problem with youth violence, isn't there any place I can go to find out what has worked in other places and why? And who are the people that I could contact to talk it through? Well, OJP needs to do that. We need to provide that. And that's what Crime Solutions is all about. It's a website that rates different approaches to criminal justice problems, and it's rated by a group of experts, and they give the program a rating of effective, promising, and shows no effects. So you could go on there and look at programs for, say, juvenile gangs, and you can find which one of those programs actually have been proven to work, which ones are promising, and which ones you shouldn't really waste time on. Because they show no effects, although they may, you know, over time, move into another category. And we've gotten great feedback on this. In fact, a lot of universities are using it in their criminal justice coursework. So I think that tool has been terrific, and we have 240 programs on the website right now, but we're adding more all the time. So if you are looking for information about a particular topic, you don't find it, please come back and visit the website again later, because you might find it then. And the next step that we took was kind of a companion piece to the crimesolutions.gov. and it's a diagnostic center, which is, it's just been launched. It's kind of in its nascent stages, but it's sort of a one-stop crime consultation service where if a community has more complex issues and they really can't quite figure out what's going on, we will work with them and we will send in a team of experts to work with them to analyze what's happening in that particular community, do an assessment, and then match up the issues with evidence-based solutions. And so now we're working with probably 8 or 10 communities around the country right now, and we are also in the process of evaluating our own diagnostic center to see what kind of results we get. We're excited about this, and I think it could be a model for technical assistance in the future, because it's one thing to pick a program off a menu of things that has been proven to work, but it's quite another to implement it in your community. You know, what are the things that make it work? Why did this approach work in community A, but when community B tried it, it just fell flat? What happened? What is it that people do in communities that make a particular approach successful? And what are the pitfalls? How do I get around this political issue? How do I get around this funding conundrum? And so it's that kind of technical assistance, that figuring it out and how to make it work on the ground that's, I think, so important. So we're using that to try to respond to these broad, complex kinds of problems and help communities develop long-term strategies, not just a quick hit with an expert who can tell you about the problem. So I think this is I'm really excited. I think this is a big leap forward in marrying research and practice, which is our goal at OJP. So we're also working on very specific, particular issues, trying to bring the full weight of evidence to bear on those issues. And there are things that you work on or that you report on every single day: recidivism, reentry, youth and gang crime, children's exposure to violence, and on and on. One case in point is our support of evidence-based policing strategies, and that's exemplified by our Smart Policing Initiative. And you probably saw John Tierney's piece in his recent piece in the New York Times on policing and prisons in New York, which is really excellent, excellent summary, I think, of the issues at play on that particular issue. And our National Institute of Justice has been really involved in those kinds of issues. They've supported David Weisbord's and Larry Sherman's work in the area of hotspots policing, and that's the kind of policing that's described in that article. We're building on that work. The Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention funded a study by Dr. Weisbord on juvenile crime hotspots. And it was really interesting, and I would say that the findings are consistent with what we know about adult crime. Weisbord's study there, which was conducted in Seattle, it found that 50% of all juvenile crime incidents occur at less than 1% of street segments. And all juvenile crime occurred at less than 5% of those street segments. So we're continuing to see the benefits of hotspot policing, and we're supporting it and helping other communities implement it. Our Smart Policing Initiative, that's administered by Bureau of Justice Assistance, pairs researchers with law enforcement agencies to design data-driven responses to neighborhood public safety problems. And, you know, it's so exciting for me to see researchers and police and cops working like this, trying to figure out the problems in their community. I've been working on these kinds of issues for decades, and I remember when I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C., and I brought David Kennedy, whom many of you know, over to the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington to talk to the police chief there about the kind of work that he was doing on data-driven approaches to homicide at that time. And the chief, Chief Ramsey, who is now the commissioner in Philadelphia, was very open to this researcher from Harvard who had hair down to his waist and didn't really look like a cop, but Chief Ramsey is a very smart guy. And after just a few minutes of conversation with David, and having read, of course, about David's work beforehand, he embraced that approach. But that wasn't true throughout the whole department. It was a little discomfort in the room when we started. But after a few months, when we actually did the homicide reviews and we had some call-ins, he had a new respect around the police department. And it's really exciting to see today that police executives are so much more comfortable welcoming, and that researchers are more comfortable too. I remember introducing David and saying he is not an egghead. Now he's a real person, and he can really help us. And now the dialogue is so much more robust and very, very exciting. We're supporting this kind of initiative, this smart policing initiative, in a number of communities, and Lowell, Mass. Is a good example of that. They're concentrating their resources there on three particular communities that account for about 60% of the crime in Lowell. There are 32 other sites, and they are all using these kinds of evidence-based approaches. We're making a concerted effort to apply this approach even to our biggest grant programs like BURN-JAG, which is kind of our flagship grant program. And we're placing a heightened emphasis on supporting approaches that are based on evidence. One example is probation that is called Hawaii Hope. And it got its name from Steve Alm, who is a judge in Hawaii and is a former U.S. attorney there. And when he became a judge, he started a new approach to probation that was based on his experience as a prosecutor. And it emphasizes immediate, predictable, and proportionate sanctions for violators of probation. And the research has shown that this is remarkably effective. It's very, very consistent, very structured. And an NIJ evaluation of this found that the new rearrest rate of HOPE participants was less than half that of other probationers. So it's definitely on to something there. And we literally have taken this from Hawaii to Alaska, where they're now implementing this approach. And we are supporting that in other communities around the country. We have a new program called Smart Probation that's active in 9 different states, and BJA and the National Institute of Justice are working together on this to test this swift and certain sanctions model around the country. It's another one of the exciting developments that we've seen at OJP. These bureaus are working really closely together. The research bureau, the data gathering bureau, the grant making and program development bureau. So it's great. There's a big focus on community corrections, and practitioners and policymakers are really focused for all kinds of reasons on trying to figure out how to drive down recidivism and reincarceration rates. And I think that actually the economy has been kind of helpful in that particular regard, because even the most conservative jurisdictions understand that we simply cannot afford to keep incarcerating and reincarcerating and building more prisons. So they're looking for other alternatives. And the Attorney General, Eric Holder, has been extremely supportive of this. He himself chairs a federal interagency reentry council that's focused on how can we, among federal cabinet members, have an impact on this cycle of going to jail, getting out of jail, getting rearrested, and becoming reincarcerated. What can we do? There are 20 cabinet agencies involved in this reentry council. And it is amazing to see how active they are. The cabinet level folks come to the meetings. They're not sending the underlings there. It's not a typical Washington meeting where you sometimes see water glasses and talking points around the room. And people are so engaged. When you look, we look at these photos of the meetings, and they're leaning in, they're animated, they're excited. And I think one reason they've been so successful is they're very pragmatic. Here's an example. When the cabinet member Shinseki from VA came to the meeting, he was informed that the VA was not getting involved with incarcerated veterans until a couple months before they were released. And he said, well, why is that? And he was told, well, it's just a policy. There's really nothing that prevents us from getting involved sooner. We said, well, I'm going to fix that. Next meeting he came to, he had fixed it. So it's really practical focus. And they, our reentry group has published dozens of what we call MythBusters. And they are fact sheets that have very pragmatic application. And they, quote, bust the myths about ex-offenders. You think that they could never, ever be able to live in public housing developments? Well, that's not true. It is not a HUD policy. It's actually at the local housing authority level. There's discretion there. And we had a great story from somebody in Philadelphia who told about her client who was released, and he had sole custody of his granddaughter. And he couldn't find any place to live, and public housing would not allow him to live there. So she took this MythBuster down there to the office and talked them into letting this gentleman get an apartment. And he got a job, and it's a good story. Things are moving along. So both in theory and in practice, we're really, I think, making a lot of good progress. And as I said, you know, legislators and policymakers from both sides of the aisle have gotten on board with this kind of approach. We sponsor something called Justice Reinvestment, where legislators and policymakers look at and analyze the crime data in their own states, and then they determine how they could reallocate resources to save money and reduce recidivism. And this is really at its core about finding sustainable ways to achieve public safety. And public safety is, that's the bottom line. You don't want to be doing things that are going to put the public at risk. But my agency is working with Pew Foundation and the Pew Center on the States and with the Council on State Governments on this to support what we call justice reinvestment. And it's been embraced in states as diverse as Kansas, Kentucky, Ohio. It's amazing, and even some of the most conservative states. I'll give you an example. The Kentucky General Assembly recently passed legislation based on a justice reinvestment analysis of, you know, who are the inmates in our state. Why are they there? What do they need? How can we make sure we don't see them again when they are released? And so as a result of their analysis, they're reserving their prison beds for the most serious and high-risk offenders, and they're refocusing their energy and their resources on community supervision and evidence-based programs. They are projecting that they will reduce their prison population by more than 3,000 inmates over the next 10 years, and that will result in a savings of $422 million. This is in a state that had the fastest growing prison population and prison budgets in the entire country. So that is real progress, and I'm looking forward to looking back over my shoulder in 10 years to see, okay, is that really what happened in Kentucky? So it's all about sharing the knowledge, convincing the right people that yes, in fact, using knowledge, using data will improve your public safety. And guess what? You might save money at the same time, and you can use that money. You can reinvest that money in programs for offenders and so on. So we're really, really excited about that. One other issue that I'm very passionate about is victims of crime and how we recognize them, how we treat them, how we provide services for them. I, from my very first case as a prosecutor, I realized that my most, perhaps my most important mission was ensuring that a victim could get through the criminal justice system without being re-victimized. And for so many victims, what really matters is that they're heard, that they feel safe, that they feel respected, especially that their dignity is respected and they are believed. And as a prosecutor, I had a unique opportunity to do that, and they cared more about that than whether we won the case. And then I ran a victim services agency, National Center for Victims of Crime, in DC. And so this has always been a passion of mine, and I've been working with our Office for Victims of Crime at OJP, and over the last 2 years, they've initiated something called Vision 21, which is a blueprint, kind of a strategic vision for the victim services field going forward. And the Office for Victims of Crime met with and had focus groups and hearings and all kinds of things all over the country with policymakers, with health professionals, with victim service providers, with victims, nonprofits, the law enforcement, the full range of stakeholders in this who have contact and who work with victims in many, many capacities to find out what are the enduring problems that victims face and kind of the enduring crimes like domestic violence, child abuse, sexual assault, and then the emerging crimes that are affecting victims, all kinds of cybercrime, for instance, and various kinds of fraud and elder abuse and so on. How can we meet those enduring challenges and at the same time prepare ourselves and actually be able to meet the challenges of these emerging crimes? What is it that we need in the victim services field to be effective? And I'll just be honest with you, we have for so many decades responded to victims based on what we feel and what we know from our psychology classes and counseling and so on. But we really, there's a dearth of solid research, a dearth of data on victims. Who are they? What's the overlap with offenders? And what works? Do we evaluate the kinds of approaches we take to victims? We know in our gut that they work, but do we have solid evidence-based proof of that so that we will know and we can adjust our approach? We don't have that. And that's what we heard from people in the field through the Vision 21 process. We need more evidence. We need research. We need data. We need technology. We shouldn't be relying on things like victim notification. You know, come to court on March 1st at 2 p.m. You put this in snail mail and it comes back, of course, you know, addressee unknown or whatever. Why don't we have an app for the smartphone? So you put the control in the hands of the victim. And all kinds, how do you serve victims in remote rural areas? You cannot count on being able to provide services face-to-face no matter where the victim is. That's just not realistic. We've got to find ways of using technology, and we have to provide the training, the technical assistance, the equipment, build the capacity and the understanding of how to use that technology. You know, you see it in telemedicine now. You see inmates getting, you know, medical care through telemedicine. We got to get smarter about the way we serve victims, much, much smarter. So that's what Vision 21 is all about. And that report will be released in the next couple of months, and so I'm very excited about moving forward with that. And I'm particularly excited because it kind of came from the ground up. So it should have great support. We're doing our best to infuse evidence in juvenile justice, the juvenile justice arena as well. And we're working on something called the National Forum to Prevent Youth Violence. Brings 10 communities together from across the country to reshape the approach to youth violence in their communities in a comprehensive way, and to look at the data in their own community and to look at the research about what works. I think the best part of that initiative is the knowledge, the sharing and the dissemination of knowledge that takes place because of the work they're doing with researchers and because of the work they do together. You know, when you bring 10 communities together for 2 days, and so the probation officers get to talk to the probation officers about what's going on in their department, there's a great spark of excitement and exchange of knowledge, and so we're really very proud of that. I think that the Department of Justice and the Office of Justice Programs in particular, as I said before, is really charged with building that knowledge base and disseminating that knowledge base, and it has to be in a very practical way. And I ask for your help. If you're a researcher, reach out to the practitioners and listen to them about what their problems are and what are the issues they're confronting. And think about your own research priorities and think about whether it's actually addressing the needs, or if you're not doing that kind of research, how does what you're doing fit in and how will it inform practice? If you're a practitioner, for heaven's sake, reach out to those researchers. Pay attention, because even though you might feel like, I don't have time for that, are you kidding? I'm putting fires out all day. You have to make time for it. You really do, because you'll be able to work so much smarter, and ultimately you'll save time and you'll save resources. And if you're a policymaker, use your leverage as a convener to bring researchers and practitioners together. And if you're a journalist, make every effort to inform your reporting with the best available data, the best available research. I'm so thrilled that so many journalists are here, because it's clear to me that's why you're here. That's what you want to do. And I think that by doing all of these things together, we will be able to really build an evidence-based criminal justice system, and one that puts knowledge at the center. And that is what I think is smart justice. Thank you very much.
So I think we have time for about 10 or 15 minutes for questions, but I thought I might start off. It's really a wonderful cook's tour through the landscape of what DOJ is doing right now, and I have to admit confidentially that, you know, thank God that smart justice is not a patented word, because we really borrowed a lot of the concepts when we were thinking about how to put together this conference and who to invite and the kinds of programs to look at. A lot of our guidelines came from some of the stuff that the DOJ has been supporting, whether it's the Brownsville Community Center, whether it's social impact bonds, and it's remarkable that over the last 2 or 3 years, DOJ has been particularly active in a way that it hasn't been historically in pushing the boundaries of criminal justice. But that sort of brings me to the first question, because we had a first panel and a first couple of panels yesterday. We're really talking about the political environment for this. And I was struck by a comment that Jerry Madden made, former speaker, former chair of the Corrections Committee in the Texas Assembly, who said that, well, because we had Bobby Vassar here as well, who was the minority counselor for the Subcommittee on Crime, and he was asked, well, what can the federal government do in pushing these programs forward? And then Jerry Madden sort of leapt in and said, well, you know, we'd rather they didn't do a lot, because it's really the states who are the incubators of all this. And But really what you're laying out is something the opposite, whereas the federal government can really and ought to push the boundaries in at a time when a lot of people think the federal government shouldn't be in that business at all on a whole number of different fronts. So what do you feel is, first of all, is the appetite for real change right now at the DOJ, at the federal level, to continue pushing these boundaries of smart justice? Or is it best at this point in our political life, in our current climate, to leave it to the states to do the incubation and then you guys support, give the support?
Well, is this on? Yes. My view, and I know that Laurie Robinson certainly held this view, is that the federal government has an absolute responsibility to play a leadership role in this arena. You know, and we work, at OJP, we work primarily with state, local, and tribal governments. You know, we're not so focused on the federal criminal justice system, although we hope they learn from what the states are doing, because that's where the real innovation is taking place. And I think that our very clear responsibility is to help to generate knowledge, build that knowledge base, get it out there, to seed programs when we know that an approach works or that has great promise. We have a responsibility, I believe, to demonstrate it through, for instance, through pilot programs. You do Hawaii Hope in Honolulu, it looks great. They're getting wonderful results. So you evaluate and, this looks even more promising. Let's seed this in other communities. Let's scale it up. And let's evaluate again. Let's tweak. Let's have a continuous feedback loop so that we can be constantly improving on what we do. That's our responsibility. We have a responsibility, I think, to push the envelope on data. You know, Bureau of Justice Statistics is moving beyond just the National Crime Victimization Survey as we've always known it. They are redesigning that survey to make it more useful. They are working with a group of police chiefs across the country to look at what they call crime indicators, which inform the FBI's uniform crime reports. Do you know that it was, I think, 1929 when that crime indicator index was developed? 1929. Think about the cars people were driving around in then. And what's happened since then? We're still using the same indicators? That's crazy. So BJS has just begun meeting with a group to kind of try to figure that out. You know, I think we have a responsibility to be a thought leader and to help local communities develop their own thoughts. There's loads of innovation that takes place out there without the feds being involved or sometimes even knowing about it. I think that's wonderful, but I think we have a very serious responsibility.
We can expect over the next 4 years a lot more innovative, outside the box, thinking of the part of the DOJ and more money.
Yeah, well, I don't have control over the money. I don't know. I would never, ever say we can expect to see more money. But in that, you know what? The fact that we won't see more money makes this knowledge base all the more important. Because you can't waste a dime. You can't waste a 10-minute segment on things that don't work.
So. Okay, let's open it up to some questions.
I'm Brendan Kirby. I was just curious as to why you think it seems to be so difficult for some of these various ideas to spread to other places that have been proven to work, and then conversely, on the flip side, why people seem to cling to these various programs that really haven't shown to have much success, but yet, I guess, you know, they get their defenders and they dig in. It just seems like you've got both of those things going on at once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what are the challenges that to adopting new practices and giving up your old ways? And, you know, there are two things. I think that people are very adverse to change, just kind of human nature. And so that's just a basic issue, not just in criminal justice, but I do think that in One of the biggest obstacles is a focus on reacting to the crisis of the day. I mean, if you're a police chief and your mayor is holding you accountable for the crime rate in your city, and you've had 483 homicides in the last year, it takes a very disciplined, smart person to be able to lift his head up and say, I have to go beyond these individual cases and these community meetings and answering to the mayor. I have to look at how are people dealing with this? What kinds of, what's the research out there? What kinds of data do I need to take a smarter approach to this crime problem in my community? So there's that, the immediacy of the issues on the ground oftentimes just saps attention and energy, and it's tough to look beyond that. I really understand that. And then, of course, funding people. There's a perception that without a huge influx of funding, we cannot change the way we're doing business. And in fact, you know, it does take money, but it's not as doesn't take as much money as it takes a different way of thinking, you know, a different way of framing the issues. The other consideration that I've seen in a lot of communities is stepping outside your own boundaries and partnering with other groups, other elements of the community, other organizations, looking to foundations, looking to your local university. You know, developing new partnerships is absolutely critical. Number one, I'm no longer in this on my own. And number two, there's all kinds of energy and ideas that come from those partnerships, and you can be force multipliers for one another. You got a problem, there's a problem in DC right now. The police chief is fighting off she's gonna have to go before the city council because the Human Rights Watch produced a report on sexual assault investigations in Washington, DC, and it's a very critical report. And her first instinct was to reach out and strengthen her partnerships with victim service providers, with folks who understand and have studied best approaches to sexual assault and so on. That's a really enlightened approach. That's not to say she isn't still, of course, kind of working the public perception and getting prepared for the hearing and so on, but smart woman. She reached out and tried to strengthen the partnerships that they had to effectively serve victims of sexual assault.
Hi, I wanted to discuss one issue that's been in the news recently. Ted Guest from Criminal Justice Journalist. Firearms research, just yesterday, National Institute of Justice put out a solicitation for research in this area. When we did an interview recently with the recently departed director, John Lobb, he basically said NIJ hasn't done much on this recently. I wanted to ask you, well, first, could you elaborate on the solicitation? I don't think it said how much money is involved, and was your agency restricted, as I think Centers for Disease Control has been, by Congress in doing any research on this, or is there any particular, I guess I'm asking, is this just coming out now because of Newtown and the president's orders, or has NIJ really been doing a lot on this, which I really don't think they have in the last couple of years, but what needs to be done in this area?
Well, I think we need a lot more research in this area. Personally, I think that the Center for Disease Control used to do some wonderful research on this for a long time. And then, of course, as we all know, that dried up, and they were basically, frankly, not allowed to continue that research. I think the National Institute of Justice, it did just release two solicitations yesterday, and if you'd like, I'll get my BlackBerry after this and give you all the site so that you could link to the solicitation, two solicitations, basically research into the causes, the consequences of firearms violence. And in addition, they are looking to the world of technology and the experts with an eye toward smart gun technology. And that's something that's just, you know, in the developmental stages right now, very earliest stages of conversation, because NIJ does have a another function, which is to oversee the development of technology, smart technology, that will help in the criminal justice field. So where do these solicitations come from? When John Lobb, who is the recently departed director of NIJ, came to NIJ, he did a really thorough assessment of their priorities, their focus, what are big issues that NIJ is not working on. Where should we be helpful in this criminal justice arena where we've been absent or minimally active? And firearms violence is one of those areas. So these two solicitations have been in the works for much longer, many months before the incident in Connecticut ever happened. So it was kind of interesting timing, very coincidental timing that those two solicitations were just released. But we at the Department of Justice are really excited to see those solicitations, and even more so, we're looking forward to the research that will come out of that. And I'm hoping that there'll be a resurgence of research in this arena across the agencies. You know, certainly CDC and HHS and the Department of Justice. Commerce does a lot of technology work, so there's plenty of opportunity in a multitude of agencies to get this research going again. And you know, when you talk about these issues, it's funny because you realize how our speech is riddled with firearms metaphors. You know, I was just about to say, get this fired up. Or, you know, you think about, you say, silver bullet or right on target. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon.
So speaking of right on target, I think we're going to have to cut it off at this point so we can move on with our program. But Mary Lou has graciously agreed to stay with us for the day. She's going to be part of a panel that we're holding later on this morning on victim services and restorative justice. So we'll have another... use another metaphor, kick at the can. but I want to move on directly to our next panel. So please stay in your places, and we're going to ask the next panelists to come up. And please join me in thanking Mary Lou for a great opening.